Here at Kilmore Quay, one of the place names that resonates from school, geography, childhood, fishing industry, and very striking journey through the town with its beautiful, unique, thatched architecture, those wonderful houses that stand out in the landscape here. And while passing one of those houses, I see a thatcher on the roof and call up a greeting.
God bless the work.
He climbs down for a chat.
How did you pick up the thatching?
I really don't know. It was probably destined for me. Got sick as a child, and I would have been, you know, like total sports head, gah. And all I wanted to do was just play for Wexford or Kerry, my mother's homeland, in football. And got sick when I was 12, and everything went to pot then after that, and lost my dreams, and everything disappeared. And I was up in the middle of Joyce's country, up in Mayo, I think it is, around a campfire, and just had this thing to ring my dad. I wanted to ring my dad, so I went down to the local phone box, and I rang him, and he said, there's a course coming up in Thatching. And I was just so lost at the time, because of being sick and then the medication. And this just fitted like a glove. 32 years Thatching now. And I've only now reached the point where I know what I'm doing. You know? And I remember the first roof I did was up the road here. And it was my first ever roof. And I remember I'd done half the front and I was coming around the hip. And it was late at night and I was under floodlights because the weather was so bad. And I remember looking at the roof is 60 foot long, and I remember looking down along it going, Jesus Christ,
is this my
life? And I remember being really despondent, you know, and just getting down. I said, okay, I'm going home, and I caught the halogen lamp to unplug it, and I was nearly killed because I got electrocuted. I remember lying there after, eventually looking at my hand like that, said, if you don't let this go,
You're gone.
I remember letting it go. And I remember lying down on the ground. And all I could see was the roof. 5 minutes earlier, I had looked along that roof and going, how am I to do this? And then someone gave me a... I'll show you.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
You will do that roof.
You will do that roof.
You will do that life.
You will do that life. Yeah, yeah. And work is great, I think. Work with purpose. Work without purpose is work. Work with purpose is so many other things. So many other things.
Wexford pulls you in. An unexpected meeting under this vast, teeming sky that seems to both dwarf the landscape and make it bigger. This is the light and sweep that the Vikings met and harnessed, the Normans looked to in their shaping and building, and it's part of what imbues today's Wexford with a rare, quiet energy and a pull of connection to the bigger world and the future.
But for me, I think because I've done nearly every house in this village now, bar one.
Really?
So I've done them all, and an elderly gentleman stopped me one day and he said to me, God, he said, Matt, if you hadn't come along, what would have happened to our little village? Up on the ladder, I always found it hard when someone would say, oh, that's lovely, well done. And you'd say, oh, thanks for it. But you'd kind of go, oh, it's not. But that was the day I said, oh, I did make a mark, or I wasn't sick for nothing.
So you've thatched almost every house in this village in Kilmore.
Yeah. My name is Matt Whelan.
Matt, it's so good to meet you.
You do, absolutely.
Vincent Woods. You know, I'm thinking, I got to get your address. You're listening to The County Measure. I'm Vincent Woods. We're making a journey around Ireland, 100 years after independence and partition, to get a measure, to get many measures of all 32 counties. We're looking at place, landscape, and the people who shape their lives within these boundaries of community and county. In this series, I'm hoping to get a fresh understanding of each county and its people as we shape a radio atlas of Ireland.
turning up Peter Street here in the heart of Wexford town, a very old part of Wexford, going up towards what's now the National Opera House, Wexford Opera, based there, all that great history of opera, and heading up the St. Peter's Square just up ahead of us, and are heading for to a pretty unique bookshop called Red Books. But there are few meanings to the word red in this context, and it might well be called well-read books.
A chalkboard sign in the front of Red Books displays an impressive figure, a quarter of a million, the number of second-hand books for sale here in this shop.
Like coming into, well, for me, it's like coming into Aladdin's cave. Rows and rows and piles of books. Trollope, the Bertrams, John Fowles, Thomas Mann, Tolstoy.
At the counter, I meet owner and founder, Wally O'Neill.
Brilliant to meet you. What a great place.
Oh, well, thanks very much. 250,000 books under one roof. Hello, Ibar, how are you?
I'm good.
Oh, it's okay. Work away. Work away. No,
Ibar's do it. One of our regular customers here.
No, go on, work away. Ask what you need to ask.
Yeah. He actually plays at the... We have an outspoken gig once a month, which is spoken word and music, and Ibar always opens it first.
Brilliant.
He's an extremely talented tin whistle player.
Oh, wonderful. Nothing like a good bit of tin whistle.
You were saying about poetry. We probably have the largest poetry collection left in the country, because a lot of people would say it's not very economical.
Yeah, a lot of the time, a lot of bookshops don't stock poetry anymore because they reckon it doesn't sell.
Yeah, but we're lucky here. We have a lot of space, and we were trying to keep books that might be disappearing from other bookshops. So we have a large poetry selection. We have a huge Irish fiction selection. So we'll carry people like Maurice Walsh and Cannon Sheen and Somerville and Ross, which sadly you can't pick up in your local Easons, or, you know.
And all great.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we've so many great writers in Ireland. We're really overran with them.
and great Wexford writers. I mean, you think of Gunther Bean and John Banville and Anthony Cronin. You know,
young writers coming up.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant, you know.
And you've started a small publishing house, haven't you?
We do. We have a publishing house called Red Books Press. It's more of a cooperative, I suppose. We started it in 2020. We've now produced, I think it's 41 books. We have two anthology series. So we have one called The Wexford Bohemian, which we're about to release number 6 during the Opera Festival this year. And we have one called Wexford Women Writing Undercover, which is it's fully female writers, poets, artists. They're fantastic.
But do you immediately get the sense that this is almost as much a centre of community as it is a bookshop?
I mean, we're very lucky that way. I guess people will often have this antiquated idea of a bookshop, that you're going to be, the owner's going to be sitting with cobwebs growing out of them beside an open fireplace reading Dickens all day. I never get a chance to read here. I only get to read at home. There's always somebody coming in, and whether they're discussing Greek philosophy or coming in to tell me their cat's missing, there's always something going on, you know. And we're very lucky to have different groups meeting here. So we have 3 Gaeilge groups now. We have a craft group,
Irish,
which is meeting
conversation
in here.
Classes.
Yeah. We have a craft group that's meeting in here at the moment. We have various poetry events. We have a music, actually. I was just talking to a guy there about setting up a new music event, a songwriters club, which will be starting in September. We have a comedy club that meets here. We have mindfulness groups and meditation, and we have this. This is a local charity that's set up base here now, Sanctuary, which is a local mental health charity, and it's all about promoting positive mental health. And so it's great. It's a bit of a hub.
And Red Books doesn't necessarily indicate politics at all.
It doesn't. Red Books is, I suppose, a bit of a pun, because most of our books have been read before.
Yeah, so well-read books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yes. How do you keep track of the thousands of books that are here?
It might seem confusing to a lot of customers, but it's done in my head. So we don't have any computerized inventory. I'll know where a book is supposed to be. I'll know what books we're short on, what we need to get in. Like, we'll get at least one van delivery a week, and people will be bringing us books in during the days as well. We'll take in books and rehome them. We'll buy books, we'll swap books, whatever it takes. I guess I'm here maybe 90 hours a week, so I kind of just know where things are.
And is there a constant movement of books? Are there people in and out, buying, bringing all the time?
There's an incredible urge for a physical book in Wexford. I think everywhere. It's just a lot of counties are not lucky enough to have these type of bookshops anymore. But we get everyone from maybe elderly people looking for a Mills and Boone or a Western or a history book to kids coming in looking for Dr. Seuss. And we actually have a group that meets here on a Saturday, the Wexford Youth Literary Society, that was set up by a girl in the presentation when she was 16. And they're just highly successful. They have kids from all the secondary schools in the town. And, you know, it makes you feel like you're doing something right when you walk past and you hear a group of 15-year-olds discussing the poetry of Shakespeare or, you know, and what Jane Austen was like on a normal day, you know. It's fantastic.
Amazing place. Really so glad to find it.
Wow, yeah, it's great to have you here.
A treasure house, absolute treasure house. And I'll have to look at the books now. See what I want
Absolutely,
to buy.
Yeah.
Not that I'm in need of any.
Bring you on a bit of a tour around the shop.
And outside on Peter Street, I meet a world traveller and regular visitor to Red Books.
My name is Declan Reck. I come from Wexford. I'm a native Yola speaker, and I'm the author of the forthcoming book, The Merchants of Wexford. Iclova, Radio 1, Erchi Arachi, which translated means I love Radio 1 every day. Yola kind of goes back to the time when the Normans start coming in, 1169 to 1171, and basically they were mercenaries. They were from Belgium, like, so they spoke Flemish. Others were English, they spoke Old English, and then you had Normans speaking Old French. Along the way, a little bit of Gaelic kind of intertwined into it. Now, in Wexford Town, as is now, there's a lot of Yola words still used. You know, you'd hear people use the word like queer. So queer is like very, or desh is kind of like beautiful. But it was a very simple language to understand. I could say that at come to E Red Books, Archie D.E. You're welcome here to Red Books.
Great welcome.
Yeah. See, I come from a political family. My father was a prominent county councillor in Wexford, and my grandfather was one of the founders of Fianna Fáil. But, like, at the foundation of the Irish state, my grandfather would have been heavily involved in the old IRA. So basically, they would have spoke a lot of Yola. So for the time I was 2 years of age, he used to speak Yola to me. And I played on that because my mother used to go mad because she'd speak to me in English and I would pretend I don't understand what you're saying. And I was like that up until I was about 6 years of age.
So when your grandfather, for instance, when the men around him spoke Yola, was that partly to disguise what they were saying?
Yeah, this part of Ireland wasn't the great Gaelic-speaking part of the country. But the ones that did, the British intelligence could decipher that. Mm. So to throw them off, they started to use Yola and they could never decipher it. But, like, unknown to, I guess, to many people, there still are native Yola speakers.
Years day with Abari, Gisting O'Rone, our gentries war Bibran, Amzil Kunustone. Yet Muslar had bahold, it was by we Tommin, at by me's look was in pit to drive in. Jowd and Maud Vremmer, Chieta was a lock, zich vaprin and shimrin, fanny da for air Scott, zich blankin and blain, fanny ball was a draw, shot while our aim was to use ne'er a blow.
You're listening to The County Measure, and we're in County Wexford.
Here on the corner of Wafer Street in the heart of Enniscorthy, the street named after Captain Thomas Wafer, who was killed in action in the Hibernian Bank in Dublin in the Easter Rising 1916, and just spotting a very attractive looking cafe up the street with the irresistible name of Heavenly Cafe.
My name is Anastasia and it's my partner Alberto. I came from Lithuania, he came from Sardinia. We met in Dublin in a hostel, So I always wanted to have my own restaurant. We came over here to Enniscorthy. I found this place online and I decided to go for it.
And how does it all compare to Sardinia?
It's very familiar because it's Iceland. It's just the weather. But the soul of the people, I find a lot of mutual point.
So you're happy in Enniscorthy?
Yes, absolutely. I'm very, very happy with Enniscorthy town. People are very friendly and very helpful.
My name is Colm Tobin. I'm a novelist. I'm from Enniscorthy town, which means I grew up beside the River Slaney. There's one bridge between the town of Enniscorthy and Ferrycarrig near Wexford town, one bridge over the River Slaney. It's a small hidden bridge at a place called Edermine. So if you're driving south from Enniscorthy towards Wexford town, there's one turn you can take. It's a tiny bridge. It's a narrow bridge. It's a narrow gauge bridge, meaning only one car can cross it at a time. It's not busy. So often when you're driving, you can stop. And if you look north, you see bits of Enniscorthy town. You can imagine the rest, meaning the spire of Pugin's Cathedral, the Catholic Cathedral, the other church, the Protestant church. You can see or imagine Enniscorthy Castle overseeing all of that, Slaney Street, Castle Hill, Market Square. But if you look south, you look into a lovely, gentle, aimless, easy river moving towards the estuary. You think somehow or other this place has remained untouched. But nothing is untouched. All you have to do is think about the two poets who wrote about this. One poet called Ludovic Brisket, who wrote in the 1590s as an adventurer and planter in Ireland. He wrote about the Urren River, which is one of the tributaries, like the Bora River that flows into the Slaney. And he lived very close by. And he spent one Christmas in Enniscorthy Castle, which is run by the Wallop family, Sir Henry Wallop, who wrote to the Queen to say that he thought that the natives should be exterminated. The other poet is Thomas Kinsler. In the 1950s, he wrote his poem Another September in a house very near the River Slaney. So when he says, near the river sleeps St. John's, it's St. John's Manor, very near where Ludovic Brisket lived. So that the two poets from the 1950s and the 1590s connect in that way, calling it St. John's. But the poem's title, Kinsella's title, Another September, also the title of his book, comes, of course, from Edmund Spenser, who wrote a poem about September, and Kinsella riffs on that poem in his poem. And Spenser was here too, overlooking the Slaney. In his list of Irish rivers, he lists the Sandy Slane. And of course, the Sandy Slane was used to get the oak forests in North County Wexford down the river, out and into the estuary, to be sent to England for the recreation of Tudor England. So the river was useful. The river is lazy. The river looks aimless. The river looks as though it's gentle, sweet thing. And it was for the poets, perhaps. It was also useful for the planters and adventurers. But I don't think about any of this as I stand out of the car now, on the bridge, little bridge at Edermine, looking south. Just looking at lazy beauty, at nothing much, at emptiness.
Heading towards dusk here on the remarkable bridge that spans the harbour at Wexford, and flags flying on both sides after the Fla, the recent Fla, the tricolour and the distinctive purple and gold colours of Wexford. Wonderful bridge, and there's been a bridge here since the 1790s, various iterations of it. Great power in the water. But walking here the other night, I met two people in high-vis jackets and had a chat with them because I'd noticed that there were life buoys dotted along the bridge, and they told me about a group they work with
Wexford Marine Watch, and this evening we're going to meet the mayor of Wexford, who was one of the founders of that group.
George Lawler, good to meet you. Vincent Woods.
Oh, Vincent, I recognise the voice.
Lovely to meet you. Great to be in Wexford. And of course, the bridge, for all its beauty, has its risks as well. And the other night, walking, I met a couple of people, noticed the high-vis jackets, and got a little bit of the story of Wexford Marine Watch, and that's the jacket you're wearing. You're involved in setting up that.
Yes, indeed. So I suppose it's ironic that the beautiful Slaney estuary here, or Wexford Harbour, is such a picturesque place, and yet at times provided families in Wexford with times of desolation. And that's, I suppose, why Wexford Marine Watch was established in 2012. Something like 16 people were jumping from the bridge each year, and we were losing quite a number of them.
And George, how does it work then? You've a number of volunteers.
We've in excess of 100 volunteers. We put them out on foot patrols. We train them, obviously. We train them in a myriad of different things, but principally QPR, which is question, persuade, refer. And that's basically what we do. No matter what the situation, we go up and have a chat to the person, and 9 times out of 10 they're fine, but the time that they're not fine, we're there to intervene and ask them what they want us to do for them. Do they want us to contact family? Sometimes we contact the Gardaí. In the cases where we would have people actually who are very intent, we've had a situation recently where there was a person standing on the wrong side of the bridge railings here, and our volunteers engaged with them for 3/4 of an hour.
Tough one.
Really tough, very rewarding, work. Sadly necessary. Wexford is a county that has a higher number of suicide attempts and suicides than any other. We're about 8 points higher than any other part of the country. So it is something that is really relevant to Wexford, and as a coastal community, obviously, the water is, whilst it holds many charms, it can also hold many difficulties for people.
George, I wonder, are there particular times, days that are special in relation to the work that you all do?
As the dark evenings come in, you would see people changing and their moods changing, and that certainly increases our full moons, believe it or not. Full moons. I was on one night myself, and there was 3 people who were attempting to self-harm, and there was a full moon. Days when the social welfare has run out can prove difficult as well. So those are difficult times.
Like triggered
days. Triggered days, yeah. And we also have people who are, sadly repeat the act, and that can prove difficult as well. But thankfully we're there to ensure that they're safe and well.
George, it's really good to meet you. And
Vincent, lovely to meet you, and thank
great,
you for coming.
Great work and you're all doing.
And thank you for showing the interest. It always helps.
So.
Kevin Weaver, we're in Wexford Town, County Wexford, on the seaside, and I'm the co-founder of the Wexford Skater Collective. Growing up in America, I was part of what's called probably the second wave of modern skateboarding. Started in the 60s, bled into the 70s. Around 1978, I got my first board, real cheap toy store board. It was about 1.5 inches thick wood, clay wheels, horrible, barely rolled.
And what age were you then?
8. Giving away how old I am now. But between Star Wars and skateboarding, that was my life. If I could be a skateboarding stormtrooper, that would have been me. Yeah, I've never been very good, but it's been a part of my life since I was 12 years old.
And this is growing up in?
Growing up
in
Baltimore, Maryland.
And what brought you skating into Wexford?
My wife got a job down here. She's originally from Sandy Cove, and she was brought on as the new director of the Wexford Arts Center. So we moved down here and give it a try, and that was 18 years ago.
But Wexford, for you, a good place to live and a good place to skateboard?
Wexford's amazing. Contrary to the size of the town, there's people from all walks of life down here, from everywhere in the world. You have artists, musicians, misfits, educated philosophers. The whole mix is down here. And when we moved back to Ireland, when she moved back and I came with her, But I got to Wexford, and it just clicked. And this is my favorite place in Ireland. I've been to all 32 counties on this island. This is my favorite place, by a mile.
Then you set up a skateboard charity.
I did. My daughter and I, just before the beginning of COVID, we started a thing called Wexford Skater Kids, which was just to get kids out skateboarding. Really, we had no aim. We had no goals. We didn't know what we were doing, to be honest. But then we started getting more and more kids involved. So we started setting up weekly events. And they got huge. Our first one had about 16 kids. The next one had about 50. By the end of the summer, our largest event had 200 kids there. We started seeing kids at the skate park that were like, oh, their boards are broken, you know, and you can see they don't have a lot of money. You know, I kind of became like the older brother kind of figure type thing, giving them advice and stuff like that. And then we give them one of my old boards for free. Take this, keep skating, because it'll keep you out of trouble, kept me out of trouble. So we started getting donations from the public. So we were able to buy new skateboards instead of just the refurbished ones. And since the end of 2020, beginning of 2021, to now, we've given away 317 brand new complete skateboards.
I love the idea of keeping the kids on the streets as opposed to taking them off the streets.
Well, that's it.
In
that's
a really
it.
Good way.
That's it. You know, like we have a simple philosophy with the Wexford Skater Collective is we're not their parents. We can't raise them, but we can tell them what's going to happen. You know, what they're doing, if they're doing something that's not quite right, you can say, look, this is what's going to happen. And if they're having trouble up at the skate park with bullying or whatever, they give me a ring and we sort it. Because skateboarding is inclusive. It was never meant for gatekeeping or bullying or any of that. It's all inclusive. And we try to keep it that way.
You're listening to the County Measure.
Driving into Rosslare and towards Rosslare Harbour, you immediately see signs saying Rosslare Harbour says no and save our nursing home, greed destroying our village, and a sign then saying ageing population, 17% of over 65s in Rosslare alone. And all of this relates to a controversy, an ongoing controversy here about the provision of accommodation for asylum seekers and refugees in the village, and one old hotel that had apparently been promised to the community as a nursing home that is instead being planned as a development for asylum seekers, for refugees. So, you know, it's a real and ongoing bone of contention in the community here. And there have been protests, but again, I think a lot of people here will emphasize that they're not against people coming in. It's about how things are managed and what facilities are made available to the community. And the feeling that, again, there wasn't adequate consultation and isn't adequate consultation with the community here in Rosslare.
Rosslare village is quiet and contained. The drive up to the port spanned by supermarket, housing estate, hotel, hostel. A tough wind whipping at things, but this doesn't deter one solitary man on a walking stick who makes a steady path towards us.
I kind of want to get a sense of what things are like in Rosslare.
Things are good now in Rosslare. You know what, they're putting up new ramps there for ships, you know. Roll on, roll off ships, you know. Back in about 5 years, I'm going to be booming.
And did you grow up here yourself?
Rosslare, yeah. All Irish people, like, you know, had to emigrate when they come to 16, like, big families and...
So did you go away yourself?
I went away at 16, yeah. But you left school at 14, like. But you couldn't go to the UK till you're 16 because you wouldn't get an insurance card, you know. You wouldn't get a job, like, you know. Well, the UK, my father was in the Air Force, like. He was in Suez in 56 when Nasser blocked the Suez Canal that time. And then in 57 he came home. He came home to the UK, West Drayton, you know, the Air Force base. And I was 16 that year, and he sent for me that year to get, I suppose, to get me off the table, you know.
Do you have a favourite place and all your travels out of all your travels?
I would like to live in Australia, but I'll tell you where I would have liked to live when I finished up. Gibraltar. That's where I intended to go, and then when you come back here, you can't get out of it. You're a paddy, and that's it. As a fella said, a savage loves his native shore. You come back to it, even if there are only trees in it, like, you know. But if you were born in a city now, or in, you wouldn't live in a place like this. Then I wouldn't live in a city. So, you know, it's as long as it's broad, like, you know.
Brexit can hardly be said to have been good for Ireland, apart perhaps from Rosslare Europort, which has seen a six-fold increase in business on the back of the UK move.
Rosslare Harbour, Stena Nordica.
The port is a hum of activity this morning, with a huge expansion underway, hundreds of workers on site, sailings to and from Cherbourg, Roscoff, Bilbao, Dunkirk, Zeebrugge and the UK.
Stena Nordica, Rosslare Harbour.
Yeah, morning Danny. Turn doors closed now. Engines ready to see. We're signalling up very shortly if we're all clear to depart.
In the operations tower, I meet Liam Pettit and Danny Ennis.
Hello. Danny Ennis is the duty controller here.
How are you doing? I have a face for radio.
What Danny would do here is he manages the staff on the ground, and he looks after the LPS system that we have here, which is radar, and that gives him a view of traffic approaching and departing the port.
So you have a whole series of screens, and then you're looking out through these tower windows on the Stena line. Ferry heading, where's that heading for now?
Fishguard.
Ah, oh, so that's Fishguard, okay. Yeah.
And alongside here on berth number 2, we have Finwave that travels between Rosslare and Zeebrugge. We have the Isle of Inish Free, Irish Ferries vessel, Rosslare to Pembroke.
So it's constant go, really.
Yeah.
Screens are very impressive, I have to say.
Yeah, so at the moment, as you can see, the Stena line going out, and then if you just look at the screen here, we have another vessel approaching the port, and they're giving an ETA here to the breakwater in approximately 47 minutes. He'll call me when he's coming up to Tuscarawk, and we'll advise him then of the weather and any other traffic movements prior to coming into the port.
So you're this constant kind of point of contact?
And for the marine safety of the vessels and everything else.
I never thought I'd get a bird's eye view of everything here.
Yeah, it's
great to see.
It's a great spot. Danny, apart from what Danny can look at here on the screen, he has a view of it himself as well.
Yeah. Great.
Inishmore now, or Inishfree, will be departing at 8:45 or about 8:40 there, Danny, won't it?
Yeah, 8:45 would be our sailing time.
Rosslare Harbour, Stena Nordica.
Stena Nordica, Rosslare Harbour, that's all copied, Richard. You're clear to proceed when ready. We have no other movements advised or recorded, and have a safe trip, and we'll speak to you later on this evening.
That's all copy. Speak to you later. Thanks, Danny.
My name is Zach Boland. I'm a composer and musician from Corktown, County Wexford. When I was asked to write a piece inspired by Wexford, I just pictured my childhood. This piece is named Anna Lane, which is the street I grew up on. I wrote this piece while remembering the beautiful scenery of the surrounding fields and farmlands. This piece opens with a homage to sunrises and mornings in my childhood home.
at the most southerly point of Wexford, Hook Head, and the splendid sight of Hook Head Lighthouse here beside me at the eastern entrance to Waterford Harbour. Really extraordinary piece of medieval architecture dating from the 13th century, 35 metres high, four stories, this amazing cylinder of white with these very, very strong black bands. And what a history in this whole area. Tintern Abbey not far away. And the lighthouse, of course, was built by Strongbow's son-in-law, William Marshall, who's the Earl of Pembroke, and really to serve the town of New Ross and the New Port there. But imagine people building that in the 13th century, and it's still standing. One of the oldest lighthouses in the world and the second oldest working lighthouse, and it's been fueled by everything: coal, whale oil, gas, electricity, and of course it's now controlled remotely, but it's still working. For me, this is one of the wonders of Ireland. This is such a connection back into our history and a connection out into the world, this beacon that continues and links us to so much, and it's such an intrinsic part of the county of Wexford.
Yeah, we're hitting them anyway. Looks good on radio.
Perhaps I'll return to Hook Lighthouse one New Year's Day when the weather is calmer to see some of the county's celebrated archers fire arrows into the sea. One of Wexford's three archery clubs is Dunbrody Archers of the Hook Peninsula, and I meet a group of them one fine evening in Tinnacarrig Woods.
Hello. Not every day you're welcomed by a group of people with bows.
Yes, yeah, and the smiles, of course, as well, you know.
Club secretary Clodagh Kiley introduces us to Pádraig Donnelly.
Nice to meet you. So Pádraig now, he's our chairperson, and he's going to show you how to shoot the bow.
Am I?
Yes, you absolutely are.
Do you want to shoot a bow?
I'd love to.
Okay. Have you ever shot before?
No.
Okay.
Never.
We're going to get you a quiver with arrows in it.
Always now fancy to quiver.
Now, I'll let you throw that around you, just like you were putting on a belt.
Yeah.
And then these are wooden arrows, and this is a longbow you're going to be shooting.
No, I need to tighten that.
Yeah. So we're looking at a mixture of targets here. It's your typical sort of archery type target. You have rings and you're trying to get it
close. It's almost like a giant dartboard.
As close to the centre as possible.
Yeah. And the arrow then sits into that groove, as it were.
It does, yes.
Just past it.
I think he moved. Guys, range is open.
There's nothing difficult about it. It's just, you know, point and shoot. Really, you know, I've only been doing it for the last year, so there's no age limit. I'm 67 and I've just started it, you know, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Great fun. Get you out in the air, meet people, good crack. The hardest thing, picking the right bow.
It's a very lightweight 25-pound longbow and sort of addictive. I believe that when Victorian ladies took it up, it was one of the first sports that women could participate in. But one of the reasons they did it was they look good, which, you know, you can sort of get.
This Hungarian horse bow. So this bow is basically what they, back in medieval times, back to Mongolians, Egyptians and all, they would have been shooting a bow like this.
Beautiful.
And originally they would have been made with horn and bone and sinew. You shoot off your hand, so there's no shelf like Pádraig and Margaret and Tony's bow there.
Beautiful object.
Yes, it's really just I like the history of archery.
This is Tadhg.
Tadhg, how you doing? Tell me, what age are you?
I'm 14.
And are there many people of your age involved?
Not too many in the club. I'm a massive history buff myself, and that's the reason I got into it initially. I was always aiming towards the kind of bow I have now, a horse bow and a medieval bow and that kind of thing. But I've really, really come to appreciate the finer parts of it, like loosening the arrow and seeing it soar through the air and stuff like that, you know.
Next.
How many members in the club here in Dunbrody?
So we are rapidly approaching 100, so it's amazing.
It is obviously wonderful to have this place here.
Yeah.
In the woods, to have this outdoor area where you can shoot your arrows.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Imagine you're back in the 16th century.
That's it. And I'm kind of weird amongst archers. I'm not a history person or a sports person. I just like to look cool shooting a bow and arrow. So it's amazing. My dad, my son, my husband, we're all in the club. And we'll go around these woods. Like, if you do it well, it takes all day long to get around the woods. And every shot, you're like, yeah, I'm in Lord of the Rings. Great fun.
Right, then is there a tradition of shooting arrows into the sea?
Ah, there is indeed, yes. And I'm going to pull Andrew back in, because this man has been involved in it and will know more about it. Andrew.
Well, the hookhead arrow into the sea ceremony originated, I think it's 400-500 years ago, and it was the New Ross Council's rights to the estuary by shooting an arrow into the sea. That was their claim for the year. So there was, since that time, there's always been one arrow shot into the sea. But I suppose, is it 12 years ago, I think Dunbro the archers got involved.
Yes.
And ever since then, our numbers, we you know,
swelled like the water. Yes. Yeah, we have 20, 30 people shooting an arrow now. We'd have 400 people, 500 people coming down to watch, marching band. And it's a big day out.
Even if the weather is not ideal, you'd be surprised it'd still be a crowd down looking at it. And it's just, we have wooden arrows that are biodegradable. Most things wash in, so everything is very good in that regard. And we just shoot a sequence of arrows out and people go, ooh, wow. You know, it's just amazing to see all the arrows in a volley going out into the sea.
Oh, that must be beautiful.
You know, especially when on a nice day when the sun is there. You know,
nice day.
And of course, the New Ross Municipal Chairman will also send an arrow into the sea as part of the ceremony.
And it's a wonderful image somehow, the idea. Yeah. I can see it in my head. Yeah. I can see the arrows going into the sea.
It is. It's great fun. It's great fun.
And it's great. A couple of years there now, our photo would have featured on one of the national newspapers.
You're listening to The County Measure, and we're in County Wexford.
Really striking mural here on the gable of Gorey Little Theatre on Pier Street in the centre of Gorey Town. Three figures in very colourful pinks, blues, greens, all quite theatrical, and I think the three people are all associated with this theatre here and its history in the town since the 1950s. And I'm going to find out a little bit more by going down to a little wooden hut, the little wooden booth here, where somebody collects tickets for parking, and those fees go back into helping to run the theatre.
Martha, hello again.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't mean to put the heart cross within you.
Martha Kinsella is sitting in a small wooden booth at the entrance to the car park.
It's fine town.
Absolutely, yeah. It never lost its mojo, if you know what I mean. Whereas other towns like Arklow and that, it's gone. But Gorey is always busy.
And I'm really impressed by the fact that when you park here in this car park, the €3 parking fee basically goes back into the theatre.
Yeah, it pays the wage and the rest then goes back in for the running upkeep of the theatre. Like.
And I'm really struck as well by the painting on the gable.
The mural. Yeah.
The mural as well.
Yeah, it's gone a bit grubby now, but you know the way it needs to be lightened up again. Yeah.
Who's on it?
Actually, want the old lady in the black actually died during the night. She's 91, Nancy Byrne. She was president of the theatre. So it's a sad day.
Ah, that is a sad
day. Yeah, for the theatre. Yeah.
Ah, so she'd had her image proudly displayed there.
Yeah, it was there. Yeah, and the other image then was
the
Gary.
Young girl.
Oh, that's
face.
Louise. She's the theatrical person inside. Great. Louise Ford. Yeah, and the other was Gary Lombard. So that's the three faces.
Ah, terrific. So you're celebrating the local talent.
Yes.
In and around theatre.
In and around, all the time.
Brilliant. And Martha, did you grow up in Gorey?
Oh, yeah, here all my life. Yeah.
Big increase in population in the last 20 years.
100%. And yet they haven't put no infrastructure in for it, you know what I mean? No parking amenities, because it's impossible to park in Gorey.
But there's also a lovely feeling in the town. Like, it's a busy, friendly town.
Anyone that stop and talk to you, do you know that way?
Well, I was delighted that the parking was a bit difficult, because it brought me to here.
Yes.
And to this car park.
Yeah.
And anytime I'm back, this is where I'll park. Let my money go to a good car. On this lovely winding road not far from Wexford town, coming in to view of the harbour, and a reminder of even the derivation of the name Wexford from, of course, the Viking naming of, my pronunciation may be wrong, Visfjord, the inlet of the mudflats. And we're coming to this remarkable human-made feature, a polder, which is land reclaimed from the sea, from the water, and it's actually 2 metres below sea level. This particular patch of land was that during famine relief work that this feature was made, and it's now Wexford Wildfowl Reserve. Going to visit it and to see this remarkable feature of the landscape here.
I meet conservation ranger Sarah Stapleton at the entrance to the Wildfowl Reserve.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Sarah.
Sarah, Vincent.
Nice to meet
Lovely to meet you.
And you.
So we're now under sea level here.
Yes. So that's the seawall behind you there. So that's keeping the sea out and all this dry. And then the pump works as well, obviously, to drain the lands. There's a big channel running through the north slab as well that kind of catches all the water and keeps the land dry for farming.
So it's a bit like the dikes in the Netherlands.
Same kind of principle, yeah.
The whole concept is so impressive. It's about 200 hectares. It's a huge site.
Thereabouts, yeah. And most of it's under agriculture. So it's kind of, I suppose, it has a dual purpose in that it's being farmed for agriculture, but it's also being farmed for nature. So for a lot of the wildfowl that come here over the winter months.
So a good balance struck.
That's right, yeah.
And reclaimed originally, I think, during the famine.
That's right, sort of around the 1840s, the seawall would have been built and the pump put in place to keep the lands dry.
So before that, this was...
We would have been sitting in a big mud flat. Yeah. So some of the species now had been here then, and then some of them would have changed with the changes to the landscape. And actually the word slob, it comes from the Irish, I think, for mud as well, so...
So with this meeting of languages and realities.
Definitely,
here.
Yeah.
Lovely, yeah. And what are the... I mean, I know there are several hundred species of birds that come, but what are the most remarkable ones that you mightn't find anywhere else?
I suppose the most important species we get here would be the Greenland white-fronted goose. So that would be a pretty unusual species in Ireland. Excuse me. We would get a substantial amount of the population here. They kind of divide between here and Scotland. And there's only a handful of sites in Ireland where they occur, and we get the most of them here.
Have you noticed any change in patterns and numbers coming in the last few years with climate change?
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah, there was a time when we had, you know, over 10,000 birds here. This is probably going back 20 years ago, whereas now that has definitely dwindled down. Their breeding success has changed and been reduced. So now we're in the region of 5,000 to 6,000 per winter. So it's not the happiest picture, but we're doing our best for them, trying to make a space that is looking after them, having them access to decent habitat, decent food sources, and obviously trying to keep them relatively undisturbed as well, because they're quite sensitive to human disturbance too. So we're going to meet James Nolan, is going to give us a little demonstration of the pump that maintains the slot.
Hello. Hello.
How are you?
Vincent Hoots, Jimmy, is it?
Yeah. Nice to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
How are you?
Wow. Tell us what we're looking at.
This is the heart of the slab, because without the pump, you will have no slab. Now, that's pumping at the moment about 14,000 gallons a minute, which is 63 or 4,000 litres. Now, that seems a lot of water.
It is a lot of water.
But it's still, there's 2,200 and a little over 2,200 acres on the slab. And that's only able to take an inch of rain off of an acre and a half in a minute. All the landowners that are on the slab pay for everything here.
So the water then that's pumped
out here is out into the sea.
Out into the sea.
Yes.
So the wall that we see outside, that's the barrier.
That was built by the Dutch in started 1847, 1848. You know, I was talking to a number of Dutch tourists here, and they said that something similar we have in Holland. Well, I said the Dutch came over here and built that.
It's so impressive. It's great. Delighted to see this. Really privileged to see that.
I'm just going to explain now.
So many images carried and stored away. A serene thatcher at work on a high roof in Kilmore Quay. A bookshop filled with lives and possibilities. The morning bustle of Rosslare Port. The big skies, the light, the people. The light in the people. In Wexford, you know it's there.